Okay. So this is actually not Orgo. I don't know if you know that was a joke. But it could be because science is an issue in Victorian times. So one thing that happens is that a certain biologist, who am I thinking of? Born the same year as Abraham Lincoln. The most major biologist ever. Came up with a theory that some people...
Darwin?
Yes! Came up with... so there's one extra of these, but not... Okay, whatever. Came up with the idea of natural selection. Thank you. When that book was published, people didn't freak out as much as you might think they did. They would, but they did freak out. And partly they didn't freak out as much as you think as you might think they would because they had already, in the earlier 19th century, first of all, there were ideas about evolution, wrong ideas, but ideas that people had. Second of all, by the end of the 18th century, by the beginning of the 19th century, people were starting to realize that the world was a whole lot more than 6,000 years old. And they were realizing it on the basis of geology. But one of the famous lines from the 19th century, which you may know, is the description of nature red in tooth and claw. Is that a familiar phrase to people? Nature red in tooth and claw. Which means that it's not a peaceful and lovely thing, that nature out there. Some of you may know recently that it turns out that one of the most destructive species before us, and we're not good as far as nature goes, but one of the most destructive, world-changing, climate-changing, great die-off species before us, or not species, genus, even families, are trees. Trees really ruined the world a couple of hundred million years ago. So this idea that trees, I think that I shall never see a sight as lovely as a tree. Trees are turned out to be part of nature red in tooth and claw. That line, anyone know where it's from? So it's from a Tennyson poem that we're going to look at, In Memoriam. So what happens is... that people are getting a more scientific view of the world, and it's not a pretty one. And that's something that Victorian poetry and the Victorian era in general, but Victorian poetry is starting to think about. There's a way in which you can say this, any English class you take, you're gonna be told the same thing, which is, this is where the modern era begins. But there's a way that you could say that what we recognize as 21st century, as a 21st century world, is starting out to, or not quite starting out, but is becoming commonplace in the Victorian era. There's the Industrial Revolution. There is all sorts of scientific discovery. There's also something much closer to universal literacy, at least in England and in lots of Western Europe. And in Europe in general, including Russia, than there was before. There's also a war in Crimea. Where's Crimea, anyone?
On the edge of Ukraine.
Yeah, depending on what you think and who you think should own it, it's part of Ukraine. Things that are familiar now, they were happening then. That is one of the things that's interesting about Victorian poetry. The flip side of that, or what comes with that, is that the Victorian era is when poetry stopped being the major literary form in English. That is to say that even though, again, depending on whose class you take and when, you could say that the modern novel was invented in the 18th century. You're nodding. With Samuel Richardson's Pamela, with Fielding's Tom Jones, It's really in the 19th century that what we think of as canonical English novels begin. So if you think of George Eliot, if you think of Charles Dickens, if you think of Thackeray, if you think of Trollope, those are, if you think of Jane Austen, those are the great 19th century novelists, some of the great 19th century novelists. And they're publishing these novels and people are gobbling them up, really eating them up. And poetry is starting to take a back seat to that. Now, the really interesting thing that then happens is that the really major, the last generation, you could say, of stunningly major English poets are the Romantics. After the Romantics, you have people who loved them, people who thought they were great, people who emulated them. After that, you have people who hated them, like Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. But what happens after the Romantics is they are the last, you could say, they're the last generation of poets who are casting a shadow over the entire literary culture in England, also in the U.S. And after that, it's the novels in the Victorian era, it's the great works are going to be regarded as the novel. So some people think, I don't think wrongly, I'm not sure I quite agree, but I don't think wrongly, that Charles Dickens is the greatest novelist in English and maybe the greatest novelist who ever lived. That may seem ridiculous to you if you've read A Christmas Carol, or you might say, yes, absolutely, if you've read A Christmas Carol, or if you've read any Dickens. Other people think it's George Eliot. Who's George Eliot, anyone?
One of the early female novelists at the time.
Yeah, one of the what female novels?
Early.
Yeah. Not that early. Jane Austen is earlier. They're 18th century women novelists as well. George Eliot is mid to late Victorian, and lots of people think she's the greatest novelist. You may have had to do her in high school. I don't think they do anymore. But they might. Silas Marner, is that a title that gives you shivers and makes you want to puke? Yeah? Did you have to read it? Could you read it? Did you find it tolerable? No, me either. So we had to read Silas Marner, I think in like eighth grade, which is just absurd. And I thought of myself as, yeah, I keep liking the stuff that people think is great, like Shakespeare. He's really good. So I thought I liked good stuff, and then they gave us Silas Marner, and it was just so awful that I couldn't read it. And then when I was teaching at Brandeis, so this was I don't know, what would that be, 18th grade, 22nd grade, something like that, 10 or 12 years later, one of my closest friends sent me his chapter on Silas Marner, which is the last chapter of his book on the Victorian novel. And I thought, okay, now I'm a professor. Obviously, I was an idiot when I was in eighth grade. I am going to read Silas Marner. And that way I can read his chapter on Silas Marner. So I read Silas Marner, and I barely managed to get through it only because I like my friends so much. Otherwise, no. So you may know George Eliot from Silas Marner, which is a pity. The only reason it's taught is that it's short. The reason it's short is because she must have realized very, very early on in writing it that it sucked. But she also wrote some of the greatest novels ever written. The ones that are probably in the running for that are Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda. They're much, much longer, but they feel much, much shorter. And they do not feel short, but they feel much shorter than Silas Marner. They're literally five or six times as long, but they don't feel as long as Silas Marner. So anyhow, George Eliot, who's, do you know her given name, her birth name? Leon, do you know? Mary Ann Evans. So, but she published under the name George Eliot. It was actually Dickens who figured out, writing a review of one of her novels, he said, she's so good on women, and she said she, that she must be a woman. So George Eliot was publishing under a male pseudonym. So were the Brontes, you may know that. Anyone know what Charlotte Bronte published under?
Carbell,
Anne Bronte, Acton Bell, and Emily Bronte. Ellis Bell. Okay, so same initials, but different obvious genders. So those are really, really, these are really, really amazing novelists. Some of them are publishing with male pseudonyms, some are not. They also wrote poetry, but they are not that well remembered for their poetry, even though their poetry is pretty good. So we're going to be doing some relatively minor poems by really major novelists. And that's not what our focus is going to be, but it's one way of looking at the transition from poetry as the commanding literary art. And by commanding, I don't mean the snootiest. I mean it's what everyone loved, what everyone was interested in, what everyone was into, what would become bestsellers, to the novel, to prose fiction as the commanding literary art. So a lot of the novelists of the time are also writing poetry. We're going to look at some of their poetry. It's all better than Silas Marner, much better than Silas Marner, and it's also really short compared to the novelists. But what's happening in the 19th century is there is this shift from poetry as the most commanding genre on the literary landscape to the novel as the most commanding genre. What that meant, or what that means, or there's a paradoxical result of this, which is that 19th century poetry, in a way, it's by no means the greatest poetry written in English, although some of it is really great. But there are more really good, you could even say there are more perfect poets or more perfect poems in the Victorian era than in any other era of English poetry. So the reason for that is that they became expert at writing poetry, and they couldn't quite think of themselves as, I mean, some did, but the kind of standard thing, which is you want to be radically original when you're a poet, that idea of radical originality is something that you're no longer quite getting in the Victorian era. It comes back with people like Pound and Eliot, who are just destroying everything that has come before, breaking all the idols and icons at the beginning of the 20th century, in the teens, let's say, more or less around World War I. But in the Victorian era, it looked like things, in a sense, were culturally settled. And in that situation of being culturally settled, what people did was they tried to write, and let's make this distinction, the best poetry they could rather than the greatest poetry that they could. There are exceptions, and the very greatest 19th century poets really were competing with their greatest predecessors, and some of them were doing reasonably well in that competition, but they always knew, you could always tell who it was that they loved from their poetry. And if you can tell that, there's a sense in which they don't have the radical originality, but part of the idea of this course is that not being radically original, it doesn't mean they're not original, they're just not radically original. That not being radically original is not necessarily a bad thing. Again, because what they do really, really, really well. A 21st century analogy or a 20th century analogy might be something like the difference between the greatest movies of all time, at least according to Sight and Sound until recently, but even if you consider the recent Sight and Sound poll, versus the really fantastic stuff that you can watch on the series is you can watch on Netflix or HBO or the movies you can go see now, where very few of them, at least very few American movies, are radically great anymore. But they are just so good. And that's how to think about Victorian poetry. It is just so good. So it's not radically great, but it is just so good. And so that's just a basic idea to have as we do Victorian poetry in this class. So what I hope you have from the bookstore is this. And what we're actually going to do is read through this whole volume. So look that appalled. If it were a novel class, this would be like one George Eliot novel, plus it would be all the way across. It would just be pure type all the way across. Here you get ragged margins, lots of space, lots of lines skipped. You have 13 weeks plus vacations, so it's good. So one of the reasons to read this is because we're going to be reading a lot of minor poets, even by Victorian standards, minor poets, but they're quite wonderful. So who, for example, would you have heard of who's a minor poet? Anyone? Victorian poetry? Any Victorian poets? You could like let your eyes slip down to the syllabus if you need to. Yeah.
I really like Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Okay, yeah, Gerard Manley Hopkins. What poem do you like?
A lot of them.
All right.
Yeah.
Famous 19th century poet Hopkins. You could think of Pied Beauty or the Windhover.
That's one.
Okay, others? All right, well, you'll learn. Minor poets of the 19th century will include, anyone know The Owl and the Pussycat? It's a song, it became a song. The Owl and the Pussycat went to sea on a beautiful pea green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a 5-pound note. Ringing a bell. All right, anyone know what a runcible spoon is? Not a phrase you've heard. It is now, if you look it up, if you Google it, which of course you're not going to do in this class because unless you have accommodations, no laptops, et cetera. But if you were to Google it, it would tell you it's a grapefruit spoon. It's one of those spoons with the little edges that you can eat grapefruit with. Why you would want to eat grapefruit, I don't know, but you can with a runcible spoon. Come on, grapefruit stinks. So it's actually, that's a word made up for The Owl and the Pussycat just because it fit the meter. It's a nonsense word that people read the poem and they said, runcible spoon, oh, that must be what you eat grapefruit with. So it's one of those things where people saw a word and they didn't know what it meant, but they figured out what it meant, but they were wrong. It's just a pure nonsense word. So that's why Edward Lear, who is often called, not truly, but often called the inventor of the limerick. There were a few limericks before him, but he made the limerick a famous form. That's not a major thing to have done, but it's certainly a culturally vast and extensive thing to have done to introduce the world to limericks. He is totally great. If you know T.S. Eliot, how many people know any Eliot? Okay, so there's a poem of Eliot's that begins... Yes, you do. You know Cats, right? Did you see that horrible movie? Okay, you're lucky. You had to read Silas Marner, but you didn't have to see Cats. But the Broadway show that it's based on is based on a book of Eliot's called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. So Eliot was a really depressed and depressing poet whose basic mode was to say, look how deeply depressed I am. It's because I understand how terrible life is and how terrible the world is. So why don't I write a poem called The Wasteland, which came out 101 years ago, came out in 1922. And what is The Wasteland? Everything! It's all a wasteland. That's where we live. But he did write some funny poems, and one has the first line, how unpleasant to meet Mr. Elliot. And that is based on an Edward Lear poem, which begins, how pleasant to meet Mr. Lear, who has written such volumes of stuff. Some think him ill-tempered and queer, but some find him pleasant enough. And he did not mean queer, it didn't have the modern meaning, but he was, and he was openly gay. So at any rate, he wrote The Owl and the Pussycat. He wrote other poems that you may know. The Dong with the Luminous Nose, not ringing a bell. Oh well, it will. Lots of bells will ring. Another even more famous nonsense poet of the 19th century. Yes.
Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll. So Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, Sylvie and Bruno. Lewis Carroll's most famous nonsense poem. Yes, see, you do know Victorian poetry. Yes, 'twas brillig and the slidy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths. Anyone know?
Outgrabe.
All right, beware the Jabberwock, my son. The jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. Okay, so if you're chortling at that, everyone know what chortle means? It's like runcible. It's a word that Lewis Carroll made up in the poem Jabberwocky. So that's a word coined by Lewis Carroll, and we now know what it means. It's become part of the English language. So here you have great nonsense poetry. A lot of the poems that we're going to read are very funny. A lot of them are really depressed. A lot of them are unbelievably lyrical because they really learned how to write wonderful lyrics. In the same way, you could say that the history of rock and roll comes to a point where the lyrics just get better and better. Same probably with hip hop, but certainly the case in something like progressive rock. I'm probably thinking of the Mountain Goats. Progressive rock. You know, do you know Belle and Sebastian? A little. Okay, Belle and Sebastian is totally great. And they learned just the way people learned to do great TV series. They learned to write really great lyrics. Probably the literal lyricist that you might know best from Victorian poetry is W.S. Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan. So how many people know any Gilbert and Sullivan? Kinda, sorta, okay. Well, we'll be doing some. But he was, as far as writing song lyrics in English went or goes, he was probably the greatest of the song lyricist of the 19th century. A rival for Cole Porter, the greatest song lyricist in English of the 20th century. But there are also lots of really depressing poems. Lots of stuff is going on politically. There is a feeling in England that that things are settled, but there is also a feeling that even though things are settled, they might become unsettled. And the Crimean War, as I mentioned before, is one reason for that. Some of the poetry we'll be reading is about the Crimean War. Anyone know? Onward with shot and shell, boldly he fought and well. Someone had blundered. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Familiar to anyone? You're nodding. Do you know what it's from? It's a charge, yeah.
I forget what side. I think it was either the British or the French. They made a charge into the Russian lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like a huge slaughter because the artillery wasn't taken out or something like that.
Yeah, because they weren't covered. Mm-hmm. So it was a really stupid order that caused huge English casualties. And Tennyson wrote a poem about it called The Charge of the Light Brigade. And if anyone has read in some other class about that genre called the novel, which I mentioned before, if anyone's read To the Lighthouse? Okay, well, it's one of the things that Mr. Ramsey is constantly quoting to when he's just walking around like a madman. People are both scared of him but also trying to get him to focus on real life. He'll say stuff like, "Someone had blundered," because he was full of himself. So he is one of the main characters of Virginia Woolf's novel To the Lighthouse. Virginia Woolf knew a lot of the Victorian poets, and her father, Leslie Stephen, knew them really well. So that is part of the background here, is that there's apparent stability. Victoria was queen for a really long time. Elizabeth II beat her at how long she got to be queen, or got to be ruler of England, king or queen. But Victoria was queen for a really long time, brought stability to some extent the way Queen Elizabeth did, but with an edge of nervousness, because the change in the world that is occurring after the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and the accession of Victoria, the Industrial Revolution as well, all of that change is, people didn't know how far it would go. So it's a little like AI now. There's a whole lot that people are seeing new things. They look relatively, or looked for a while, relatively stable. But the context of that is an edge of nervousness. And there's also general skill, much more widespread skill in writing than there had been at any time before this. But that skill, as I say, is starting to go, or the appeal is for prose fiction rather than poetry. But the poets of the era, some of whom are prose fiction writers, some of the greatest poets of the era, are known more for their novels than for their poetry. George Meredith is an example of this. Not that anyone reads George Meredith anymore, but you should. Has anyone read George Meredith's fiction? The Egoist, or The Ordeal of Richard Feverel? Okay. Well, he wrote a sonnet sequence called Modern Love, which is very modern, in that the love totally collapses at the end. Or it's about the collapse of love. He's generally in everyone's top, and by everyone I mean English professors who do Victorian novels. I mean, who else could I mean by everyone? Top 15, maybe top 10, for some people top 5 Victorian novelists. But this sonnet sequence is really, really, really good. So we won't read all of it, but we will read some of it. If you, as I say, they're the Brontes. Both Charlotte and Emily Bronte wrote really good poetry. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, do people know who she is? Is that a familiar name? Who is she married to?
Robert Browning.
Robert Browning, yep. Her great long poem, which we're only going to read a little of, is called Aurora Leigh. And how many people read Jane Eyre? Okay, well, Aurora Leigh kind of plagiarizes Jane Eyre, which is interesting. And when she said, look, when people said to her, look, you kind of plagiarized Jane Eyre, so spoiler, you want a spoiler? How many people know what happens at the end of Jane Eyre? There's a fire and something happens to Rochester, which turns out to be bad for him but good for her. No? All right. Well, the same thing happens at the end of Aurora Leigh. With the same thing happening to the male character, whom the female character is interested in, let's say. So it leads to a happy ending. So did she plagiarize from it? She definitely got the idea from Jane Eyre. She said, yeah, I got the idea from Jane Eyre, so what? But she was when she was writing, she was regarded contemporaneously as the greatest poet in England at the time. People don't think of her that way anymore, but she is really, really, really good. Okay, this is just so you get a sense of what you're getting into. And basically what you're getting into is you're going to read a lot of really good poetry. Very little of it is super famous, so it's not going to be the kind of thing that you're supposed to have learned in college, like Shakespeare, especially if you're an English major or an English grad student. But it is the kind of thing that people really liked at the time. Anyone who read poetry really liked Victorian poetry in the Victorian era. And they did because it was so breathtakingly competent. And I stress breathtaking rather than competent here, because it is breathtaking. It is really, really good. If there hadn't been other poets that the Victorian poets had learned from, if you had these poems in a vacuum, you would regard them as world historically great. But we don't have them in a vacuum. We have them responding to Shakespeare, responding to Wordsworth, responding to Shelley, responding to earlier poets who are world historically great in a way that the Victorian poets aren't quite. But what I'm trying to say is it doesn't matter that they're not quite. These poems are poems to read for pleasure. And that is a good thing, to be able to read for pleasure. Okay, so let me just quickly tell you important things on the syllabus, which is page numbers are in the Rick's anthology, and so you should just be keeping up with the reading. There are two papers. The first one is due March 8th, and the second one is due May 3rd. They are both to be 1,200 to 1,500 words long. You can get, there will be a final during final period. I'm sure you're hearing this in all your English classes or all your classes with papers, which is ChatGPT is not going to cut it. I partly know this because I had a lot of conversations with ChatGPT about Victorian poetry, and it is really bad on Victorian poetry. It says things that are absolutely false, which is bizarre. Have you done that? Have you looked at things where ChatGPT just says things that are simply factually wrong? Have you tried it out? Or?
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, good. It's an artificial intelligence that people are wasting a ton of time on that they could be wasting on first-person shooter video games instead. But it was just recently released. You could try it. You ask it questions. If you ask it about something cliched, it will give you a reasonably accurate cliched answer. But if you ask it about something that isn't a cliche, it's going to say things that are totally wrong. People are freaking out about it because it's going to replace all of us, and certainly you won't be able to write English papers, but in 5 years from now, there won't be lawyers needed anymore, doctors, and what are we going to do? But right now, it's actually, a friend of mine who's an expert on this thinks it's got a long way to go, and it's not clear that you should be freaking out about this at all. This is my friend who wrote the software that tells you when someone is texting back. You know, when you get the little, you can see they're texting, but you don't see, he's the guy who wrote that. So he at least knows something about computers. So anyhow, ChatGPT is, you can ask it questions, you can waste a ton of time talking to it. I asked it to tell me a Jewish joke. Actually, I asked it to tell me a joke about whitefish. And so the joke it told me is, why did the whitefish turn red? That's the riddle. And the answer is, because it saw the salad dressing. So funny, right? Okay. The salad was dressing, so it blushed. Okay. But so I asked ChatGPT, why is that funny? And it said, because it makes no sense. And I said, okay, what do you think dressing is in that phrase? It saw the salad dressing. And it said, it's a noun. Salad dressing is something you pour on salad. So I said, no, it's a verb. It saw, it's actually a participle. It saw the salad dressing. And ChatGPT said, oh, yes, it's a verb. That would mean that the salad was putting dressing on itself, which was weird, which made the white fish blush. So that's...
A for effort.
What for effort?
A for effort.
You give it an A on that? Really? Oh, my God, great inflation. All right, if your paper sounds like that, you don't get an A for effort. How's that? So ChatGPT has a long, long way to go. Do you all know the comic strip Nancy? Oh, you should. At any rate, some people asked it about Nancy, and it just got all the relationships among the characters wrong. Really, really perversely wrong, interestingly wrong, but wrong. Okay, two papers, there will be a final exam. You can memorize 100 lines, a total of 100 lines for extra credit, which I think you should, and then you would recite it to me. You don't have to do it in front of the class. You would recite it to me, and you get extra credit for doing that. So that's a good way to get extra credit. Basically, if you've taken a class from me, you know that any improvement that you make will count more. So the basic way to think about this is if you write a good first paper and a bad second paper, you'll get the average of your two grades for the paper grading part of this course. If you write a bad first paper and a good second paper, the second paper will count more. So deteriorating in the course of the course won't hurt you more than a pure average, but improving in the course of the course will help you more than a pure average. So you can always redeem yourself at least to some extent. And as I say, doing some memorization would be a good thing. There's boilerplate at the end of the syllabus, but that's basically what you need to know. And as I say, for who we're doing and when, just look at the pages in RICS that are on the syllabus. We're going to do roughly the same amount of reading for each week, a little bit more towards the beginning and around vacations than towards the end, because you'll have your other classes to deal with all the stuff that they pile on at the end. Okay, so any questions about that? I think that's straightforward enough. Liam?
Yeah, so the 100-line memorization, does it have to be one of the poems we covered in class?
Talk to me if it isn't.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't have to be, but it does have to be a Victorian poet. Okay, questions, comments, concerns? Okay, good. Let us look at the second sheet, which is a bunch of poets. Part of the reason that I headed this out is to start giving you a sense of the relation of the Victorian poets to their Romantic predecessors, who were their most immediate and overshadowing predecessors. Partly you can see that in people like Matthew Arnold. So do people know who Matthew Arnold is? Okay, he's most famous for a poem called Dover Beach, which used to get taught in high schools all the time, and some people would say, oh, this is the greatest poem ever written in English. That's the poem that ends with, where ignorant armies battle by night. Arnold was actually not at all a great poet, but he tried really, really, really hard. He was a really important critic, unfortunately, because his ideas were bad. But he was a really important and convincing critic. Because he tried so hard, he was a pretty good poet. And Dover Beach, as I say, is his most famous poem. Arnold really liked Wordsworth because he thought that he could be a bit like Wordsworth. He really hated Shelley. Do you know who George Bernard Shaw is? The great playwright. So Shaw said, which I think is absolutely true, that in every election there is a Shelleyan vote, although it's very hard to count. That is, people who vote the way they do because of Percy Bysshe Shelley. Percy Shelley, married to Mary Shelley, some of you will know, was one of the great romantic poets. One of the absolute radicals in English poetry. Karl Marx said about Shelley that every true revolutionary, and another thing that's going on, by the way, in the Victorian era is Karl Marx, Marx and Engels, the Communist Manifesto. You know where Marx did all his work? Anyone? He went every day to work and work.
I know he worked in London, I believe.
Yes, at the British Library. So he had a British Library card, he would go there and work every day. For hours at a time. So Marx, very famous, well, he said a lot of famous things like, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Less famous, but still famous, is his saying, every true revolutionary laments the fact that Shelley died when he did, although they don't lament the fact that Byron, Shelley's best friend, died when he did, because Byron would have, in his older age, become a conventional bourgeois person. They both died very young. Shelley died at 29, Byron died at 36. Would have become a conventional bourgeois person, but Shelley would always have been a revolutionary. So Shelley got kicked out of college, when he was in college, for writing a little book, a short pamphlet-type book, called The Necessity of Atheism. And Shelley basically got kicked out of England for his political views, as well as stuff in his personal life that people didn't like, some of which we don't like either. But Shelley was absolutely radical. Matthew Arnold, who is the opposite of radical, said of Shelley, he called him a great luminous angel beating his wings in the void in vain. So Arnold thought, Shelley thought he was so cool, but he was really kind of spectacular, but it was all empty and specious. So Arnold really liked Wordsworth. He didn't like Shelley. The opposite of that is Robert Browning, who is probably one of the two Victorian poets, the other one being Tennyson, the nature red in tooth and claw guy. We're also going to do Yeats, who is late Victorian, but also we're going to do the Victorian poetry of Yeats. He's also a major modern poet. But of the true Victorian poets, or totally Victorian poets, Tennyson and Browning are probably the greatest. And Browning was obsessed with Shelley. His first long poem was a poem about Shelley, and all through his life, he was obsessed with Shelley. So if you look at a poem which is very famous by Browning for really interesting reasons, the poem on, it would be on your right-hand sheet, called Memorabilia. Does someone want to read that out loud? What's your name?
Matt. Did you once see Shelley playing, and did he stop and speak to you? And did you speak to him again? How strange it seems, and new. But you were living before that, and you are living after. And the memory I started at, my starting moves your laughter. I crossed a moor with a name of its own, and a certain use in the world, no doubt. Yet a hand's breadth of it shines alone, mid the blank miles round about. For there I picked up on the heather, and there I put inside my breast a molted feather, an eagle feather. Well, I forgot the rest.
Great, thank you. So that is actually a very famous poem. And the memorabilia is in the poem, it's the feather, that he finds this molted feather, this eagle feather, and I forget the rest. What do you think of that last line? Well, I forget the rest. Anyone, what do you think of that as the last line? What's your name?
Quinn. It's a very easy ending.
Okay, it's an easy ending. It is, notice that it's a little bit short if you're hearing the rhythm. We won't spend a lot of time on technical aspects of poetry, but they inevitably come up. A molted feather, an eagle feather. Well, I forget the rest. Does it seem anticlimactic to people? How come? Matt.
I guess it's anticlimactic in the fact that there's this sort of emphasis on the voice of Shelley in the beginning, and then we only hear the feather, and that's it.
Yeah, okay. That an eagle feather, that's something, even though it's only the feather. There's a great Shelley poem called The Two Spirits, an Allegory, which Browning may or may not have been thinking of, which goes, O thou who plumed with strong desire wouldst float above the earth, beware, a shadow tracks thy flight of fire. Night is coming. So that's what the first spirit says to the second, and the second just has contempt for the fear of the first spirit. But the first line, O thou who plumed with strong desire wouldst float above the earth. So plumed there means having the feathers flying through, having the plumes of strong desire. So the idea of the eagle, of something that soars, that in Browning's own life, he found an eagle feather, an amazing thing. And the rest of the moor, who cared? There was this eagle feather. But now it's 20 years after Shelley has died, and Browning meets someone who once met Shelley. And it's like, oh my God, I'm 1 degree of separation from Shelley. But this person, he just laughs when I said, you met Shelley? Holy cow, you met Shelley. But the memory, so just look at the plot. Did you once see Shelley playing? He asks someone who saw Shelley playing. Did you once see Shelley playing? And did he stop and speak to you? And did you speak to him again? How strange it seems and new. I was that close to contact with Shelley, a single degree of separation. Do you know the Grateful Dead, Quinn?
Yeah.
So you know the song, you know the line, shake the hand that shook the hand of P.T. Barnum?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So, I can shake your hand and you shook Shelley's hand. That's incredible. But what did it do to the person he met? Next stanza, just plot summarize.
Plot summary?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the summary of the guy laughing at him, right? It's, this guy had a life before and after meeting Shelley, but Browning says, this is the biggest event in your life to me.
Yeah, to me, it's the biggest event in your life. What about to the guy he met? No, yeah, I met Shelley, so. Yeah, it was a commencement. He came, he gave a talk, he left. Which would never have happened because he was kicked out of Oxford. Look, this has to be the most important event in your life as far as I'm concerned. And the guy he's talking to laughs. But you were living before that, you were living after the memory I started at. My starting moves your laughter. And then what does Browning do? Is he still talking to the guy in stanza 3? I crossed a moor with a name of its own and a certain use of the world, no doubt. Yet a hand's breadth of it shines alone with the blank miles round about. Do you think he's still talking to the addressee of the first two stanzas? I'm going to try to ask genuine questions in this class. I'm going to fail because I'm an English professor. But I'm going to try to ask genuine questions rather than questions where I already have the answer in mind. So, do you think he's still talking to the guy explaining or not? Why not? What's your name?
Santa. It just seems like he's left the person, like, crossing a moor, and kind of just like in his own head about everything.
Okay. Yeah. I like that way of putting it. Yeah, good. Quinn.
I kind of imagine a scene where he's still talking, but the other guy's already walked away.
Yeah. All right. Or the other guy's walked away and he's saying, what? And then thinking of something that happened to him, which is crossing this moor. So it might well be, what do other people think? Does anyone think he is still talking to the guy? Yeah.
I don't think he is. I think he is comparing it to, I don't know if this is a real experience that he had that he's going off of, but kind of in the same way that this person he's talking to, like, has had this whole life that's, like, unrelated to Shelley, because it's his own life, and he's doing other things, and it's not a huge deal to him. You know, this moor, you know, it's his name, you know, it has, you know, a use, but none of it matters to him except for this one small amount, and so that's kind of how he views this meeting with Shelley. It's a similar kind of parallel.
Okay, yeah, so it's,
yeah,
so it's definitely a parallel. I guess the question is he explaining to the guy or is he explaining to himself? It's definitely a kind of explanation for why he was startled that he'd met someone who'd met Shelley. So he's definitely explaining that. The question is he explaining it to the guy or not? It's obviously not an important question as far as interpreting what he's saying goes, but it might give you a sense of tone, or you might have a different sense of tone if you think he's still explaining why he started at that memory. The memory I started at, I started moves your laughter, or whether he's explaining it to himself, let's say. Which is to say to us, rather than simply to the guy. It might affect the tone. And you might prefer one reading to the other. That he's still explaining, hey, doofus, it's like you found an eagle feather and you had no idea what you found. Or it might be, yeah, this once happened to me. And for him, he met Shelley and... my finding an eagle feather, that was something really pretty amazing. Imagine if I'd met Shelley. So, again, I don't think a lot hangs on the difference there because the meaning is going to be the same, but it's worth spending time deciding on what tone you're feeling in the poems that you're reading. There's a poem by Stephen Vincent Benet. Do people know who he is? So he's most famous for John Brown's Body. You know who John Brown is, right? So he's most famous for book-length celebration of John Brown. He wrote a poem which begins, I forget what it's called now, actually, but he's an American poet, but he wrote a poem that begins, did you once see Shelley Plain? Ah, that's a great poem now, says the speaker of Binet's poem. And it turns out that that speaker is someone who did see Shelley Plain. He was in school with him, and he was one of the people who bullied Shelley. So now he is a middle-aged to old man, and he's remembering what their childhood was like together. But as I say, Shelley died at age 29. So this is a poem that has heirs. So if Browning is thinking, and he did write, as I mentioned before, his first long poem, which is kind of unreadable, so we won't read it, don't worry. Not as bad as Silas Marner, but that's not a high bar to clear, is a poem called Pauline, which is a poem about Shelley. And Browning really was obsessed with Shelley. Here is a poem where he might be thinking of the two spirits in Allegory or other poems where Shelley talks about eagles. So he is writing a poem in response to Shelley's poetry. And then Binet writes a poem in response to Browning's poem responding to Shelley. So that's just something to notice is going on. Browning also wrote a poem that we will read called The Lost Leader, which is about how there's this great leader and he led us into this fantastic adventure, but he turned into a fool. And that the Lost Leader is about Wordsworth, who you may know turned into a fool after the age of 40 or so. Most of Wordsworth's poetry is written in the second half of his life, and it's really, no one reads it. It's really bad. Occasionally people try to read it and say, I have an idea. I'm going to write a dissertation about how good Wordsworth's later poetry is. And then they go to law school instead because it's no good. Sorry, grad students, I'm not looking at you. Browning was really interested in the Romantics, and you can feel it here. And what he's saying, I forget the rest. It's like, no, I'm not going to write a poem with a fantastic, romantic, exploding ending. It's an eagle feather, and I kept it. And there's nothing else that I have to remember. Not only that, I don't have to insist. All I can say is, I forget the rest. There is this eagle feather. I forget the rest. So this is one, I wanted to start with this as a poem which is partly about how well the Victorians, or some of the Victorians, thought about their relation to the Romantics. Take a look at the first poem on the left-hand sheet. The Phantom Wooer by Thomas Lovell Beddoes. So Beddoes was another poet who's obsessed with Shelley. And this is from a very strange, unfinished, weird play, very, very, very rarely produced, but not never, called Death's Jest Book. And Beddoes was had a lot of songs in this play. This is, and he was kind of death obsessed. So there are two things that obsessed him, Shelley and death. And just to get a sense, it's a completely different kind of Victorian poem, and not, again, typical of what we're reading, but still worth knowing about. The variety among Victorian poems is astonishing. So, just to read it, The Phantom Wooer, a ghost that loved a lady fair, ever in the starry air of midnight at her pillow stood, and with a sweetness, skies above the luring words of human love, her soul, the phantom wooed. So that's The Phantom Wooer. Sweet and sweet is their poisoned note, the little snakes of silver throat in mossy skulls that nest and lie ever singing, die, oh die. And then here's the wooing that the phantom wooer does. Young soul, put off your flesh and come with me into the quiet tomb. Our bed is lovely, dark, and sweet. The earth will swing us as she goes beneath our coverlid of snows and the warm leaden sheet. Dear and dear is their poisoned note, the little snakes of silver throat in mossy skulls that nest and lie ever singing, die, oh die. So that doesn't sound very Victorian, that death obsessiveness, that death is wooing. Really Beddoes, you could say, that there's the tone of the poem is one in which he is feeling the power of that siren song of the phantom wooer. And as I say, Beddoes, basically he thought about death and he thought about Shelley and he thought about very little else. So that's another example. I want to give you a third example. I'm just basically trying to give you some sense of the range of poets and also the surprisingness of some of the poets we'll be doing in this class. Look at the poem after Memorabilia, which is called Magna Est Veritas, as they pronounce it at the time. Anyone have any Latin? What's it mean?
Truth is great.
Yes, truth is great. Literally, I mean, if you do a word for word, it's great is truth, but in Latin, word order is not the same as in English. Yeah. So, truth is great. Anyone know who Coventry Patmore was? So, there's one phrase that he's very famously associated with, which is, it's often misquoted, but the phrase is, the angel in the house. So, is that familiar to people? Sometimes the angel of the hearth, or in the hearth. So people say, oh, Coventry Patmore, God, he was just so sexist. And the angel in the house, or the angel of the hearth, is supposed to be, it's received, it's not actually true, but it's received as the little woman who's supposed to be making the wonderful house while the man goes out and is a big capitalist, and then comes home and there's this perfect domesticity that the angel is doing. So that's how he is remembered, if he's remembered at all. It is a misreading of him. He did come up with the term, but he, in a context of which he's very skeptical of that. But this is the kind of thing, now that I've said it, you'll notice it when you see it. It's people say, oh, I'm not going to be the angel of the hearth. And that's a phrase, like Nature Red and Tooth and Claw from Tennyson, that's a phrase that comes from Patmore. But this is a pretty depressing poem. So what he says is, and I think maybe this is a way to think of a lot of Victorian poetry, he's out looking at the sea, and he says, not at a moor, but at the sea, here in this little bay, full of tumultuous life and great repose. So you're reading a poem which is, the truth is great, that's great. It's actually, the whole line is, the truth is great and will prevail. So, magnus est veritas et praevalet. So here in this little bay, full of tumultuous life and great repose, where twice a day the purposeless glad ocean comes and goes. So the first word you should notice as unexpected is purposeless. The truth is great, so what do you mean purposeless? So here in this little bay, full of tumultuous life and great repose, where twice a day the purposeless glad ocean comes and goes, under high cliffs and far from the huge town, I sit me down. So he's looking at the ocean coming in and out. And then he says, for want of me, the world's course will not fail. I don't have to be doing anything. The world is going to be doing what it's doing. When all its work is done, the lie shall rot. So eventually good things will happen, right? When all its work is done, when the world's work is done, the lie shall rot. The truth is great and shall prevail. And then this stunningly surprising last line, when none cares whether it prevail or not. So that's a very grim poem that sounds like it's an optimistic poem. When will the truth prevail? When no one cares anymore. It'll prevail, but so what? The lie shall rot, but so what? The truth is great and shall prevail when none cares whether it prevail or not. Okay, we have a couple of minutes, so just quickly, here's a Christina Rossetti poem. Some of you may know Goblin Market. Familiar to anyone? Great poem of hers. We're going to do her poetry. We're going to do her brother's poetry. I'll do a limerick I'll tell you a limerick by her brother. This is a limerick dedicated to the poet Val Printemps, and it goes, "There was a creator named God, whose ways are some of them odd. I maintain and I shall, the creation of Val, to whom the poem is written, reflects little credit on God." So why did God do that? Why did he create this guy? It reflects little credit on him. So that's a nice 19th century limerick. Here's a song by Rossetti. "When I am dead, my dearest, sing no sad songs for me. Plant thou no roses at my head, nor shady cypress tree. Be the green grass above me with showers and dewdrops wet. And if thou wilt, remember, and if thou wilt, forget. I shall not see the shadows, I shall not feel the rain, I shall not hear the nightingale sing on as if in pain. And dreaming through the twilight that doth not rise nor set, haply I may remember, and haply may forget." So one of the things that's going on, maybe, with the coming of Darwin is a sense of biology rather than a sense of Christian salvation. There are a lot of poems about Christian salvation in Victorian poetry, but there are a lot of poems about, it's all biology. Just two more poems really quickly, the last two. "Cradle Song at Twilight" by Alice Meynell, who was a Catholic poet and did believe, and was also really concerned about all the young men being sent off to war. But here's a little lullaby, "Cradle Song at Twilight." "The child not yet is lulled to rest," so the child is still awake. "Too young a nurse, the slender night so laxly holds him to her breast that throbs with flight." So it's nighttime, but the child isn't going to sleep. "He plays with her and will not sleep. For other playfellows, she sighs, and unmaternal fondness keep her alien eyes." So the night is not interested in this child. The night is not maternal night, but unmaternal. And finally, "In a Christian Churchyard," a funny poem by James Thompson, also known as, his pen name was Bysshe Benolus. Anyone know what the name Bysshe is?
That's the middle name of Shelley, right?
Yes. So he's obsessed with Shelley. Benolus comes from the contemporary with Shelley German science fiction and fantasy novelist Novalis, who is really, really great. So, "In a Christian Churchyard." "This field of stones," he said, "may well call forth a sigh." So it's a churchyard, lots of gravestones. "Beneath them lie the dead, on them the living lie." So it's a little joke. You may see this graveyard and sigh at all the dead underneath the stones. "Beneath those stones lie the dead, on them the living lie." What does that mean? What's the joke there? Yeah. I'm sorry, what's your name?
Cam.
Oh, right. Yes, Cam.
Play on words, meaning sort of, you know, Christ, it's like, oh, they believed in him, but really it's all back to biology.
Yeah, and what's on the stones is just lies. Oh, what a great person, you know, loving father of, loving husband of, blah, blah, blah. No. So the dead are lying under the stones, and the people who are engraving inscriptions on the stones are just telling lies about the dead. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a whole lot of the opposite of piety. I wouldn't call it impiety, but a whole lot of exploding of piety in Victorian poetry. So a lot of what we're going to be doing is counter the cliches of Victorian poetry, counter what people tend to think it's about. Victorian poetry is weird as all get out. And another aspect of it's not aiming quite for greatness is that it's willing to be really strange. Even the poets you don't think of as strange at all, like Tennyson, they are really strange. And that's what we're going to be paying attention to. Okay, I kept you a little long, but questions, comments, concerns? If not, or even if so, I will see you next week. Okay. Have a good weekend. Keep up with the reading. That's the one thing that I would urge you to do. Keep up with the reading.
I do
have a
birthday.
Sorry?
My aunt's back in the business of English literature. Her birthday is over 30 years ago.
Oh, wow.